I want to talk to you this afternoon about the power of storytelling. Faith begins inside of story. Centuries ago, a man named Siddhartha sat down beneath a Bodhi tree, closed his eyes, felt the suffering of the universe, extinguished his desire, and awakened enlightened, ready to walk the earth with an unending flow of compassion that transformed all he met. In another time, in another place, a man unlearned in letters by the name of Muhammad sat down and closed his eyes, opened his mouth, pristine wisdom flowing forth, the great mystery of the Quran that has flowed down through the centuries, generations and generations in devotion. And a man nailed to a cross, hands and feet bleeding, crying out for the Lord. He is left for dead. But days later, he appears on this earth, reveals himself to his people, tells his followers to take heart, to find courage, to be so bold to walk the path of love with him. Love is dangerous business. Courage is dangerous business, these stories seem to tell us. And yet, the fact that we know these stories, the fact that we are sitting in temples that celebrate these stories, show us that love lasts. Love lasts beyond these bodies, beyond this time. Love and courage, the courage to love, is our inheritance. Stories of faith give us this, stories that have come down to us. But there are also stories of faith that are happening all around us, here and now, if we have the courage to hear them, if we have the courage to tell them, and if we have the courage to share them. I believe that such stories, our stories, your stories, have the power to change the world. Now you may think, really, storytelling? What is storytelling to the violence that we hear in the news every day? To blood spilling in the streets of Ukraine, or on the steps of a Jewish community center in Kansas, or in a Sikh Gurdwara in the middle of Wisconsin, what is storytelling to structural racism in the face of social inequality, decades of war and poverty, disease? What can story really do? I want to show you this afternoon. And I want to begin by telling you my story. Tell me a fact and I'll learn, but tell me a story and it will live in my heart forever. I heard this when I was a little girl. So I always loved hearing the stories of my faith, the stories of my family. This is how my story begins. In the year 1913, 101 years ago, my grandfather sailed by steamship from India to California in order to pursue the American dream. He arrived proudly with his turban and long beard, practicing the Sikh faith, but stepped on the soil of a country that had laws that did not permit him to become a citizen because of the color of his skin, did not permit him to own land. He arrived at a time when riots against people who were Latino or Asian or African American were common. He arrived at a time when his fellow travelers felt the pressure to remove their turbans, to cut their beards, their signs of faith, their articles of faith, in order to be accepted as American. And yet my grandfather had the courage to keep his faith. He dreamt that one day his grandchildren would be able to walk this land as citizens, and so he wanted to show that it was possible to be both sick and American. I grew up with these stories, and the one that I most love is the story of what he did during World War II. When his Japanese-American neighbors were rounded up and put into concentration camps, what we call internment camps, many of them lost their livelihoods, their farms, their property, lost everything. But my grandfather was one of the few people who looked after those farms. He hitched his buggy and wagon and traveled through the deserts to post in Arizona to visit them when no one else would. He came back from that trip with a piece of petrified rock that still sits on my family's fireplace, a reminder that to be a Sikh is to serve humanity. And that to serve humanity, to love your neighbor and serve your neighbor, is really the best of what it means to be an American. I took that story with me as I grew up on the farmlands of the Central Valley of California. I wanted to be as brave as him, but I didn't quite know how. Until September 11th, 2001. All of us remember that day. I found myself watching the towers fall over and over again between images of Osama bin Laden wearing a turban and beard. I was grieving the tremendous loss of life just miles from where we sit now. But as I began to see that face, it dawned on me that America's new enemy looked like my grandfather, looked like my cousins, uncles, looked like my family. And within hours, we began to hear news of hate violence break out on city streets across America. People chased, people gunned down, people stabbed, people beaten, houses of worship set on fire. And in the emails and the phone calls, what I heard repeatedly from my Sikh and Muslim neighbors was, someone is going to die. Someone is going to die. And then on September 15th, Balbir Singh Sodhi, a Sikh man standing in front of his store planting flowers, was gunned down by a man who called himself a patriot. He was the first of several dozen people murdered in the year-long aftermath of September 11th. He was someone my family knew, so it felt like an uncle had been murdered. At that moment, I ran to my bedroom and I hid. I didn't want to look outside. I didn't want to claim my place as an American whose country had become so afraid, or as a Sikh whose community was suddenly terrorized. And I think I would have stayed there. I would have been stuck there. But it was the stories of my grandfather, and it was scripture that echoed down to me. Nam, Dan, Ishnan, it means many things in Sikh scripture, but my family always taught me it means, in order to realize yourself, in order to realize God or Vaheguru, you must act here and now without fear. I think I would have still been hiding if I did not have the stories of my family and faith. But I was not alone, because they were in my heart. And with that, I grabbed my camera, got in my car, and crossed the country, filming the stories that were unfolding, that were being buried beneath the anthem of national unity, with the hope that if America just heard these stories, it would be the starting point for healing as a country. This was the first time I discovered storytelling, the act of storytelling, as sword and shield, as a way to fight the good fight. What resulted was a film called Divided We Fall, a film that some of you have seen. It told the Sodhi family story, but also the story of many other families, including this image. This is in my own hometown, the Gurdwara that I would go to as a child. In the face of that kind of violence, those kinds of messages, There were also families who expressed hope and resilience and courage. And so the film captured all of that, a people longing to be seen as fellow Americans. So in my mid-20s, when the film was done, I got on the road again and began to travel around the country to show this film. I was thinking, this film is going to help people learn about my people. Little did I know that I was the one who probably did most of the learning in those years on the road. This is what happened. I'm standing in Chicago, and the audience has just seen the film, and a man in the back stands up, African-American man, points to his braids and says, "My braids are my turban." Here in New York City, a gay man stood up and said, "I have fought and fought and fought for the rights of LGBT people to come out of the closet, to be seen as fully human. I realize now that so too I must fight for the right of Sikhs to wear their turbans." And in Nebraska, a young Japanese American woman stood up and said, "My grandparents were interned during World War II. When very few people visited, your grandfather did, and I realized that I, now, decades later, must show up for you the way that he did for me." These remarkable gestures of recognition, this recognition of solidarity, was transformational for me. It made me understand that my community's struggle, my people's struggle, was not just our own, that our struggle is inextricably bound up with the struggles of so many communities in these United States, with the African American, the Latino, the Native struggles, the struggles of Muslims and Jews and all kinds of Christians to be seen and heard and understood the way that they see themselves, that our struggle is part of a broader movement for human dignity and civil rights in this country. And if I was going to be serious about social justice, then I needed to be able to serve all of them, to stand with all of them the way they were standing for me. And so I began a journey of experimenting with the power of storytelling, not just to create solidarity, but actually to push for social change in the ways that I was seeing around this film. So what I would like to do next is give you three case studies, three glimpses into the three different powers of storytelling I have had the privilege to witness. Storytelling as redemptive, storytelling as reformation, and storytelling as transformation. Are you ready? Storytelling as redemption. In February of 2009, I found myself in the basement of a Catholic church in East Haven, Connecticut. In a circle, Latino families were sitting with their children on their laps. A priest stood up. He had called this meeting because he had heard complaints from the community. He led the congregation in prayer, and then he opened the floor for people to tell their stories. One by one, these men and women stood up, pulled back their sleeves to show their scars. They had been harassed and beaten at the hands of local police officers. It was horrific to see that this could happen in our country, but even more so that no one knew about it. I asked them, "Why not tell your story? Why not tell it to the public so that we can change it?" And they immediately shook their heads. It was too dangerous, they said. It was too dangerous. It was largely an immigrant community. So Father Manship, Father James Manship, you see right there, stood up in the church and had a blackboard behind him. And he asked the people, "Who has the power in this town?" And the people yelled, "The mayor, okay, the mayor, yes. The police, yes, of course, the police have the power in this town. Who else?" And one young woman in the back raised her hand and said, Dios. He said, yes, God. God has power. And someone in the front stood up and said, the people. The people. And the priest said, yes, the people have power with God in their hearts. And by the way, we have our lawyers. And the entire room looks over to me. By the way, I was a first-year law student. I was not even a lawyer then. I took a deep breath. I gulped. And in that moment, we became a coalition. We became a coalition of faith leaders, of parishioners, and of their lawyers, their advocates. Because you see, it's far too dangerous to ask someone to go out and tell their story if no one is standing next to them, if no one is standing behind them. That true solidarity means putting ourselves on the line, not telling folks what to do, but being right there, having their back. What began in that church on that night was a 3-year campaign of working to tell these stories to the American public, starting with the state of Connecticut. I remember the night before our very first press conference, we were staying up, we were working on their narratives, getting them in shape, practicing them with the men and women who were about to speak at the podium the next morning. We were exhausted. And the next morning, we all gathered in a space that feels very much like this. And the press is waiting outside. And I'm like, okay, looking at my clock, we better get going. But the priest is adamant that we've got to pray. And so I'm like, okay, let's pray. Go ahead, pray. And the priest leads a small prayer. And then suddenly, the congregation bursts into song. It was a song in Spanish. It was a Christian hymn come down to us through the centuries. It was a song of liberation filled with yearning and longing to be free. The stories of their faith were giving them courage to stand up. And as I sat there as a sick woman who had always felt herself outside of the Christian community, tears began to flow down my face as I felt a God that was large enough and grand enough and beautiful enough to take us all in one spiritual moment. The people stood and singing, they walked out of the darkness of the basement of the church into the light of day. Literally, from the dark to light. And in that moment, I saw the redemptive power of storytelling. You see, violence strips us of agency. Violence strips us of voice. It renders life unsayable, unspeakable. But in order to reclaim our voice, in order to reclaim agency, telling a story, making sense, putting it in order, and then making it understandable, making it a tool to change so that it would not happen to anyone else as it happened to that person. That transition, that act, is a redemptive act. We can never give people back their full security and health and peace of mind. Despite what the law says, we can never fully make people whole. But what story can do is redeem that violence, redeem that time, so that people can move forward in their lives. When they stood behind that podium and told those stories, it was the beginning of an incredible stretch of time where we told that story in front of media cameras. We told it in the form of a lawsuit. We told it in the form of a complaint to the U.S. Department of Justice, which then investigated the police department. And I am proud to say, fast forward, the East Haven Police Department now has a new police chief. The four officers most responsible for the violence have been arrested and imprisoned. And the U.S. government has instituted a monumental consent decree to transform that department for good, to serve all of its people. The power of story, the power of storytelling for social change. Ready for the next story? storytelling that has the power to reform relationship. A few years ago, I returned from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where I was there to observe the military commissions. We know that people still languish without cause, without conviction on that base for years on end, called the worst of the worst. When I returned to Yale Law School, where I was finishing up my degree, I was troubled to realize that they were men held in conditions of solitary confinement just a few miles away from my law school that rivaled the ones I saw at Guantanamo. Guantanamo is only possible because of a culture that relies on mass incarceration on this soil. And this culture of mass incarceration has given rise to what we know, what we call supermax prisons, prisons that are entirely designed to hold people in isolation. Now, we've had solitary confinement since the beginning of this country, but it's only in the last few decades that each state has built an entire facility to hold people in isolation 23 hours a day in conditions that the UN calls torture, if for more than 15 days. We had seen that advocates across the country had been trying and trying to reform, to challenge, to fight on behalf of prisoners, and we wondered what could we do for Northern Correctional Facility in the state of Connecticut that would actually work. So I went back to this idea of story, storytelling. Okay, the stories of just the prisoners don't seem to be working. And this is the thing about storytelling for social change. When a story reifies a division between us and them, it doesn't ever really lead to transformation. A true story for social change tears down that wall dividing us from them and creates a we that reforms relationship. We began to talk to the prisoners to get their stories on camera, but then we began to talk to the them, to the folks on the other side of the bars, these correctional officers. And what we found was astounding. These men and women talked about high suicide rates, high alcoholism rates, high depression rates. They talked about going into work each day like they were entering a combat zone. They talked about the building itself making them see the folks on the other side of those bars as animals, just as they saw them as less than human. And suddenly, we began to see that the true problem, the bad guy in the story, was the facility itself. So we created a film called The Worst of the Worst that gave voice to all of the folks inside of that prison. I want to tell you what the film did, but first, would you like to see a few pieces from it? Yes. All right, we're going to show you two clips from the film, the opening, and then we'll show you a little bit at the end, and then I'll tell you what happened.
As far back as 1890, the 19th century, the Supreme Court recognized the risk of solitary, describing the isolated inmates at one prison with the following words: "A considerable number of prisons fell, after even a short confinement, into a semi-fatuous condition, from which it was next to impossible to arouse them. Others became violently insane. Others still committed suicide."
I came in on a wheelchair, strapped down. He They strapped me up, gave me a shot of Ativan and Benadryl. I woke 2 days later, and I realized I was still chained up. You ain't got nothing but a metal mirror, metal toilet, you know, metal sink, metal chair, table, metal bed. And you gotta sleep there. You gotta think there. You suicide there, you know. You sleeping on other people's blood and dirty stuff. You can't talk through the doors. You can't speak to other inmates. I start talking to the wall. I start seeing stuff. You can hear these voices and literally hear them. And they talk to you and tell you to do things. And you go and do them and not realize that you're doing, that you're going through this pain. And that's when I start calling myself, biting myself. And it all happens because of that self, because of that self.
The United States holds far more prisoners in segregation or solitary confinement than any other democratic nation on earth. What do America's prisons say about our nation and its values?
The reason why we came to Summers was for the fact that it was a safe, nice community with a very good school system and, you know, for our children to be raised, you know.
There's a stretch along the road going into Summers, Connecticut, and suddenly you say, oh, okay, this is clearly where all of the prisons in Connecticut are. And then you go past 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 prisons, and then at the very, very end of the line, there is Northern.
This is not even scenery to me. I don't really even see this area here, so I kind of try to blank it all out, you know, and just focus on the fact that I'm gonna see my son.
Water Tower said it all. Everyone knew that the prison was at the Water Tower. Summers was known if you were anywhere in the state of Connecticut and they said where you're from, you'd say Summers, and they would say, oh, that's where the prison is. This is the main entrance. This is, you know, this is where I grew up.
Yeah, that's the beginning. That's the front of Northern right there.
To the mall, and for one reason or another, something triggers it, and I have to get to a quieter portion of the mall, put myself back against the wall, and regather myself. Certain noises, you know, people running. When you're in prison, people running, that means they're responding to something, an emergency. So when you see people running, it's initially you want that, you get that jump, you get that, I'm going to react, I'm going to respond.
It would be like a constant stress or pressure of someone who would be, you know, in a combat situation where you know it's coming, when is it going to come, and what's going to happen. I've seen, you know, staff members, their whole personality change. They may abuse certain, you know, alcohol, or may get caught up in a drug situation at times. Their family life changes. They withdraw. I know of several people who have committed suicide.
The COs themselves are trapped in this house of mirrors, and all they're seeing is the day-to-day struggle between us and them. And it's, for I think for some people, it can be a really terrible environment that just really doesn't bring out the best.
It's funny, I talked to a correction officer not long ago, and we were talking about how twisted we become because of the job, where we sit around and we talk about a guy that was eating his feces and kind of laugh it off. Where if you did it at a family picnic, your relatives would be gathering up the kids and leaving.
They had a rule set in where, they never implemented it, where you can only work at Northern for 3 years because of the mental stress it causes. Well, I thought that was a good idea. Maybe they should have kicked me out of there 10 years ago. But I stuck it out and I stayed. The reason I stayed is because, you know, all my other buddies stayed and I'm staying with them. I got their back, they got my back. I work with some great guys and, you know, I'll go into battle with those guys.
You have to strip naked every time you come out of your cell and lift your testicles, he doesn't say testicles, and turn around and grunt. Some COs do it out of spite because they just want to sexually harass you, telling you to drop it like it's hot, or they say nuts and butts, or they hold your clothes until you're all the way naked, and then they say, nice, nice. Now, Layton has gotten two or maybe three what they call tickets because he's refused to do that. And I don't necessarily, you know, agree that he should break the rules, but in this instance, I support him. That's why we're on this phone call slash visit alternating cycle, because every time you get a ticket, you lose the privilege of either a phone call or a visit. He'll make an attempt to seem like he's okay when we have our visit. You know, he smiles, he'll you know, make jokes with me and things like that. But his eyes are they don't reach his eyes, you know? I'm afraid for him. I'm afraid for him.
What every inmate go through in Northern, you only get take so much, you know, and I end up trying to hang myself. And what happened was a lieutenant came in there and instead of like opening up the door, cutting me off the noose, because I was unconscious, you know what I mean? And he maced me. Coughed up blood, I kept coughing, and they maced me again. And they kept macing me and told me to cuff up. Correction Department of Corrections, Northern Correctional Institution, legal phone calls. I mean, I use that to write on. You know what I mean? You come across a lot of them. They go another request I go on. I can't free my mind because they took my soul. Who's looking to save me? 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 Save me.
The second clip in the film, which really makes more clear that you saw the introduction of these various characters at the very beginning. We really kind of give life to the stories of both the prisoners, their families, and the correctional officers. And I'm proud to tell you that, you know, when we started this film, there were 400 inmates held in Northern Correctional. With the same justification we hear at Guantanamo, they're the worst of the worst. A huge percentage of those inmates are non-violent offenders, people who are deemed to be problematic in general population. They may have been in there for shoplifting, but then end up in solitary confinement, often for months and years on end. Their stories, alongside the stories of these correctional officers, show that the system was not working and that it was terribly costly to the American people. By the time we released the film, alongside a report produced by Yale Law School, the Department of Corrections themselves saw the film, read the report, and decided to empty out the prison. 400 to two dozen. It didn't require, like in East Haven, we were marching in the streets, right? But this was a different way to create change. It was reforming relationship. It was creating change from the inside. And so now the film is on tour in states around the country. Happy to show the full thing here, Jackie, if you'd like later on. We're so happy that it's been used as an advocacy tool for lawmakers in particular to do the right thing and shut down these prisons. This was an example to me of the power of story as reformation. I want to tell you how my journey came full circle in this last example. After working with all of these different communities on all of these different issues, from immigration to stop and frisk to prison reform, my journey came full circle on August 5th, 2012, when a gunman walked into a Sikh house of worship on a Sunday morning. On a Sunday morning, a prayer hall like this, where men, women, and children were sitting in prayer, walked in and opened fire. Open fire. It was the largest act of violence on a faith community in the United States since the 1963 church bombing in Birmingham that took four little girls. And yet in that moment, watching that screen, hearing the cries of aunties and uncles, people who I considered my brothers and sisters, my children, I felt so alone. I felt as alone as I did immediately after 9/11. And I thought, in all of these years, in 12-some years, had anything really changed? All of our work, all of our using story and advocacy, how it could not prevent what happened in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. But then the phone rang, and it kept ringing, and it kept ringing. And it wasn't just my Sikh and Muslim friends. There were people from all over this country calling to share their love and support. And this was happening in every city. I know in this church, people of all different faiths, Christian, Jew, Muslim, people of all different colors, began to, unlike after 9/11, actually heard the story, actually saw that screen, watched the news, and began to stand up to say, that's not just your family, that's our family too. We too pray on a Sunday morning. We too wish for a world where all of us can live, work, and worship without fear of violence. President Obama lowered the flags to half-mast. There were hundreds of vigils with thousands of people who came and showed their love and support. And in that moment, I saw, as I was working on the ground with the families of Oak Creek, I saw how this love and support transformed that community. It gave these young boys and girls, these young women and men who had just seen their families killed, the power to stand before the cameras and call for an end to hate, not just against Sikhs, but against all Americans. They were able to show the essence of their faith because of that love. The news media packed up and left 1 week after the tragedy when Mitt Romney announced his vice presidential candidate, Paul Ryan. And so there were no cameras in the temple to show how the people, 1 week after that massacre, gathered again in the house of worship to pray. There were no cameras to capture how the congregation prayed not just for every single family who was affected by that violence, but they also prayed for the soul of the gunman. In that temple, there was a young boy who I sat next to, 18-year-old Harpreet Sahni. And he told me after he heard the news that his mother was one of the people who was killed, that he wanted to seek revenge. He's 18 years old, a young man. It made sense. He was angry. But it was the community, and it was the stories of our faith that saved him, and it was the love and support from the American people, from all of you, that turned him away from anger and hate to love. And so we decided, after the news media was done telling our story, that we wouldn't stop, that we would use the story to try to prevent another Oak Creek. And so together, standing next to Harpreet, we traveled with this young man. These Sikh advocates and organizations and our partners traveled with this young man from the fields of Wisconsin to the halls of power in Congress, where he became the first Sikh in history to testify. And at this Senate hearing, what did he do? He told his story. He asked for those senators to do something so that another family wouldn't have to lose their mother as he just did. And he asked those senators to take the first step, which was to track hate crimes against our community, against the Hindu and Arab and other communities. Can you believe it? In all the years since 9/11, we have been making this ask to the US government, at least measure the problem so that we can respond to it. We've had no success, but this young man tells his story to melt the hearts of those senators. And 1 year later, President Obama announced that we would be making this monumental policy change. So storytelling has transformative power. Storytelling can transform culture, as we saw in the days after Oak Creek. The ways that we are still telling the story allows all people of faith, all Americans, to see themselves in the Sikh experience, to understand we have all a stake in making sure that our temples are never stained with the blood of hate. And we use story to change policy. I want to show you a film that was part of that effort. It's called Oak Creek In Memoriam. It's a film that we made that's about 9 minutes long. It went viral a few months ago and was part of President Obama's decision to make this change.
Yes, Milwaukee Sheriff. Hello, can I help you?
I'm calling from 7512 South Howard Avenue. There is shooting.
Okay.
There is shooting in this.
Okay. Did anybody get hit, sir? Did anybody get hit? Ma'am, sir.
Shooting.
Ma'am, sir. Shooting. Sir, I understand that. Did anybody get hit? Hello?
And then I remember her trying to wake us up, probably around 9, you know, and none of us woke up, just like any other day.
You know, with my grandpa, it was just a normal day. So we just thought it was just another day.
I was dropping my wife and my son off.
Pantry में जो kitchen वाले pass के room है ना baby room कहते हैं उसको यहाँ पर वो मतलब ऐसे है ना
मतलब crackers होंगे
हम ऐसे मतलब सोच रहे थे फिर मेरे को लगा पापा जी ऐसे उधर देखने जा रहे क्या हुआ
बाहर तो से देख क्या भाई कुछ बंदे गड़बड़ का कोई बंदा गड़बड़ कर रहा कोई मेरे उन्हें
My brother was driving, I was driving, and then my brother called me and was like, somebody opened fire at the Gurdwara. Papa's been shot.
He's like, there was a shooting. And we're like, okay, you know, where's grandpa?
Started to get phone calls from other people saying that, you know, your dad's been shot. There's been a shooting inside. We hear your mom's inside. She's in the closet.
ਕੋਈ ਨਹੀਂ ਹੈਗਾ ਇੱਥੇ ਜੇ ਕਿਤੇ ਉਹਨੂੰ ਪਤਾ ਲੱਗ ਜਾਂਦਾ ਨਾ ਵੀ ਅਸੀਂ ਇੱਥੇ ਲੁਕੇ ਹਾਂ ਜਾਂ ਕੁਛ ਹੈ ਫਿਰ ਸਾਨੂੰ 15-16 ਨੂੰ ਉਹਨੇ ਮਾਰ ਦੇਣਾ
ਸੀ ਦੈਨ ਆਈ ਕਾਲਡ ਮਾਈ ਮਮ ਰਾਈਟ ਅਵੇ ਸ਼ੀ ਵਾਸ ਲਾਈਕ ਆਮ ਸੇਫ ਆਮ ਇਨ ਦ ਪੈਂਟਰੀ
ਤੇ ਬੈਡ ਅਸੀਂ ਵਿੱਚੋਂ ਬੰਦ ਕਰ ਲਈ ਇੱਦਾਂ ਖੜੇ ਰਹੇ ਇੱਕ ਦੋ ਟਾਈਮ
ਤੋਂ ਇਸਕੇ ਪਾਪਾ ਜੋ ਥੇ ਇਨ ਬੱਚੋਂ ਕੇ ਪਾਸ ਆਏ ਖੜੇ ਰਹੇ ਵਾਂ ਬੱਚੇ ਮੇਰੀ ਬੇਟੀ ਰੋਤੀ ਰਹੀ ਬਹੁਤ ਪਾਪਾ ਪਾਪਾ ਮੰਮੀ ਪਾਪਾ ਕੋ ਨਾ ਕੁਛ ਹੋ ਜਾਏ ਬਹੁਤ ਰੋਤੀ ਰਹੀ ਮੇਰੀ ਬੇਟੀ
ਆਈ ਕਾਲਡ ਹਰ ਐਂਡ ਸ਼ੀ ਡਿਡਨਟ ਆਨਸਰ ਹਰ ਫੋਨ
ਵੇਅਰ ਇਜ਼ ਹੀ ਵੇਅਰ ਇਜ਼ ਹੀ ਮਮ ਵਾਸ ਲਾਈਕ ਆਈ ਡੋਨਟ ਨੋ
ਵੀ ਆਰ ਕਾਲਿੰਗ ਏਵਰੀਬਾਡੀ ਲਾਈਕ ਏਵਰੀ ਨੋਬਡੀ ਇਜ਼ ਗੈਟਿੰਗ ਥਰੂ ਏਵਰੀਬਾਡੀ ਇਟਸ ਲਾਈਕ ਕੇਆਸ
ਆ ਕਾਲ ਫਰਮ ਦਿ ਪੁਲਿਸ ਚੀਫ ਵੀ ਹੈਵ ਐਨ ਆਫੀਸਰ ਵਿਦ ਸ਼ਾਟ ਵੀ ਆਰ ਔਨ ਸੀਨ ਡੋਨਟ ਨੋ ਅ ਲੋਟ ਆਫ ਦਿ ਡੀਟੇਲਸ ਯੇਟ ਬਟ ਵੀ ਨੋ ਦੇਰ ਇਜ਼ ਸ਼ੂਟਿੰਗ
ਮਤਲਬ ਹਮ ਫਿਰ ਉਸਮੇ ਛੁਪੇ ਰਹੇ
ਆਈ ਐਕਚੁਅਲੀ ਟੁਕ ਆਫ ਇਨ ਮਾਈ ਕਾਰ
ਵੀ ਹਾਈਟੇਲ ਇਟ ਓਵਰ ਥੇਰ
ਦੇ ਹੈਡ ਦਿ ਹੋਲ ਏਰੀਆ ਬਲੌਕਡ ਸੋ ਆਈ ਕੁਡਨਟ ਗੈਟ ਐਨੀਵੇਅਰ
ਨਿਕਾਲੀ ਪੁਲਿਸ ਨੇ ਮੈਂ ਬਾਹਰ ਸੇ ਮਤਲਬ ਬਾਹਰ ਆਈ ਪੁਲਿਸ ਉਹਨਾਂ ਨੇ ਕਿਹਾ ਕਿ ਹੈਂਡਸ ਅਪ ਕਰਕੇ ਬਾਹਰ ਨਿਕਲੋ
ਸਾਨੂੰ ਇਹ ਨਹੀਂ ਸੀ ਪਤਾ ਲੱਗ ਰਿਹਾ ਵੀ ਸਾਡੇ ਬੰਦੇ ਮਰ ਜਾਣਗੇ ਸੀਗਾ ਵੀ ਚਲੋ ਅਸੀਂ ਅੰਦਰ ਲੁੱਕ ਗਏ ਆ ਕੁਝ ਬੇਸਮੈਂਟ ਚ ਲੁੱਕ ਗਏ ਆ ਅਸੀਂ ਸਾਰੇ ਬਚ ਗਏ
ਪਾਪਾ ਕੋ ਦੇਖਾ ਮਤਲਬ ਉਸ ਟਾਈਮ ਉਨਕੀ ਆਖ ਤੇ ਪੂਰੀ ਗੋਲੀ ਲੱਗ ਰੱਖੀ ਸੀ
ਜਸਪ੍ਰੀਤ ਕੀ ਹੋਇਆ ਤੇ ਜਸਪ੍ਰੀਤ ਦੇ ਮੂੰਹ ਚੋਂ ਇੱਕਦਮ ਨਿਕਲਿਆ ਪਾਪਾ ਜੀ
We came back around 9 o'clock and they called us into the room. The moment they told me, the moment I realized I'll never see her again. Not a day goes by when I don't think about that day and I still get goosebumps thinking about it.
man entered the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. There were about three dozen people there. Six people were murdered, plus the gunman himself being killed. The gunman shot Lieutenant Murphy, too, at least eight times at close range. An incident of domestic terrorism.
Sita Singh, 41 years old, male. Ranjit Singh, 49 years old, male. Satwant Singh Kaleka, 62 years old, male. Prakash Singh, male, 39 years old. Paramjeet Kaur, 41 years old, female. Shubhik Singh Khatra, 84 years old, male.
President Obama today ordered all flags in the United States to fly at half staff.
All of us are heartbroken by what's happened, and I offered the thoughts and prayers not only of myself and Michelle, but also of the country as a whole. In this country, regardless of what we look like, where we come from, who we worship, we are all one people, and we look after one another, and we respect one another.
Japo Sat Naam Ji, Wahe Guru, Wahe Guru, Wahe Guru Ji.
We're not going to let this tragic event define our city. We're not going to let that happen. We're going to take every measure and every step to make sure that doesn't. Let people see the letters of support. These are letters from all over the world, all the United States, some local residents. Offers of help, there's offers of money. Here's a letter from the White House, from the president. It is overwhelming. They continue to come in every day.
Darkness can't drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hatred can't drive out hatred. Only love can do that.
From members of the Sikh community all over the world, I've gotten emails from. They're raising money, they're doing fundraisers for him. Thanks and praise, it's just amazing.
I want to be a law enforcement officer like Lieutenant Brian Murphy, who saved so many lives that day. We ache for our loved ones. We have lost so much, but I want people to know that our heads are held high. My mother was a devout Sikh. Like all Sikhs, she was born to live in Chhor Dikla, a state of high spirit and optimism. I want to protect other people from what happened to my mother. I want to combat hate, not just against Sikhs, but against all people. I don't want anyone to suffer what we have suffered. I want to build a world where all people can live, work and worship in America in peace. Despite everything, I still believe in American dream. In my mother's memory, I ask that you stand up for that dream. Today and in the days to come.
out of the mountain of despair, a stone of hope. The work of justice is hard and the road is long, but I see these moments as stones of hope. They show us that storytelling can give us the courage to change the world, but they also show us how to use story to change the world. There's a method. There's a strategy. And I believe each of us has the ability to do it.